So welcome to the final part of our trip through the letter to the Philippians. And I'm going to obviously keep it brief tonight because we've had a nice meal together. And actually because this chapter's not that interesting, I have to say. He's, particularly the second half, he's going to say thank you because they've supported him financially and we talked about that already, so there's no great insights. I will tell you one thing that I think is really interesting. During the week, I'm giving a lecture at the School of Theology in January about Anglicanism, and I was reading and researching, and I discovered how Christianity came to the British Isles. And most people think like St. Augustine or St. Patrick or someone like that. But at the same time that the church was spreading west around the Mediterranean was the time when Britain was being colonised by the Romans, Julius Caesar and all that. And it looks like actually Christianity first came to Britain with Christian Roman soldiers who were posted there. And so St. Alban, our first British martyr, was actually a Roman soldier. We're not absolutely certain of his dates, but it looks like some people reckon as early as 209. So by the very beginning of the 3rd century, there are Christians in England, and then Julius and Aaron, whose church we used to go to when we were in Wales, they were also Roman soldiers who were martyred for their faith in England. And it just got me wondering, I wonder how those Roman soldiers became Christians. And thinking back to a couple of sessions ago where Paul is rejoicing that the gospel is spreading all through the imperial guard and everything, wouldn't it be funny if we are here tonight because someone who was chained to St. Paul got posted over to England? The Rainy Island, as an American friend referred to it yesterday. I just thought that was really interesting.
Yes.
I thought you'd like that. So Paul, at the beginning of chapter 4, is returning, I think, to this idea of Philippi as a Roman colony. And I wonder whether we could read really just the first 9 verses. I'm not going to take it very much past that. Yes, I am. Sorry, I'm going to 13. So maybe 3 people could read, according to my Bible, 1 to 3, someone. And then 4 to 9, someone else. And then 10 to 13, someone else. Who'd like to do those? I want to focus, and I think you talked about this the week that I wasn't here and Chris did it, but about that phrase, stand firm, in verse 1. And they would know what he was talking about, because as a Roman colony, they would have had a detachment of soldiers whose job it was to guard the city, and if any attack came, then they would stand firm. And I thought you might be interested in this little clip of Roman soldiers and the way that they went about it. Do people know what testudo is? It means tortoise. It's Latin for tortoise.
That's it. Yeah, that's the one.
And it looked like this. These are not real Roman soldiers. They're history students. I think real Roman soldiers had things other than noodles thrown at. And I did find another clip with real arrows and blood and people dying and that. But I thought that you might not enjoy that particularly. But I think that's the image that Paul's got in mind. Stand firm and stand together. Now, in chapter 3, he's talked about attacks that are coming in from the outside. And you remember the dogs who wanted, who were saying, you've got to be circumcised if you really want to follow Jesus. But in this chapter, he's moving on to talk about attacks from the inside. And he begins with these two women. And he says, whether it's coming at you from outside or whether it's bubbling up within the church, you still need to stand firm. You need to be together and put that protective tortoise shell around one another. And Roman soldiers who didn't stand firm when they were being attacked from outside wouldn't be much use. But also they wouldn't be much use if something bubbled up and disrupted their kind of formation, as it were. So what's going on? Let me just backtrack a bit. So stand firm in the Lord. I'm sorry, I'm making a real pig's ear at this. Don't worry, I'll edit it out and it will sound fantastic when it goes up online. It will sound like I really know what I'm talking about. Okay, so stand firm. Look how he describes them in verse 1. My joy and crown. Now, when we have the picture of a crown, you probably are thinking that, yeah, which is kind of what a king would wear. Mm-hmm. Actually, Paul isn't talking about that. He's talking about one of these. Now, why would you get one of those kind of laurel wreath? Do you know what you would have to do to get one of those?
Was it either win a battle or, yeah?
Or win a race? It's a gold medal, yeah. Like a gold medal in the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And Paul's describing them as his crown. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really good thing as a church leader, to look on your congregation and say, I've won. I've done a good job with this lot. They're still standing firm, even though I'm locked up many miles away. That's a victory. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that one of the things that we would want to do is to make sure that this chap gets one of these because of the state of the church that he has created almost literally from nothing. Mm-hmm. Actually, and it would be great for Jim to feel as he looks out over St. Swithin's, this is my victory. This is what, not in a kind of how wonderful I am way, but you know, this has worked. And I can look back on churches I've led and I can look back and say, yeah, we won there. That was a victory. And I can look back on others and say we lost that. A couple of different places where I think, you know, you do your best, but actually it didn't work, make that much difference. So I think that would be a really good ambition for St. Swithin's, to stand firm both against what comes at us from outside, but also internally with our relationships, so that Jim can feel that he's got that crown on. Now, he's going to talk about, not Jim, Paul, is going to talk about four internal threats in the next few verses. Let's see if you can spot what they are. Some are easier to spot than others. See if you can find what might threaten their standing firmness, their unity, in the next few verses up to verse 9. Any ideas? Yeah, that's obviously the first one, isn't it? You've got that quarrelling in 2 to 3. Yep. Anxiety is there. There's another one which is kind of hidden in there. I'm interested in the everyone there. I've got let your gentleness be evident to all. Who's all? Who's everyone? Outside the church. Yeah. I think that is a call to a kind of outward looking, well, we'll talk about that in a moment, but there is something about the outward facingness of it, and so a threat might be too much of an inward focus where we forget that we are being observed as Christians. Yep. Then someone said anxiety. Yep. And one more. Where are you getting that? Okay. Yeah, that's right.
Think about that.
I've got a slightly different word for it, but it's focus. Yeah, so okay.
Sort it's of just keeping focus.
It's about focus. That's right. I just happen not to have chosen that word. The word I have chosen is pollution. Now let's talk about those in turn, because he lists those as four things that might get them into trouble. These two women, first of all, it's very interesting to see how he deals with them. Now bear in mind that this letter would go back and would be read out in the church and maybe in other churches nearby. We know that some of his letters, we talked about that, haven't we, in the past, some of his letters would be read. Now, imagine someone standing up at St. Swithin's and saying, I've just had a letter from the Archbishop of Canterbury or something. And he reads it out and he gets to this bit where it says, I plead with Chris and Sue to be of the same mind. Yeah, it's real name and shame, isn't it? If you were those people. And I think there is something actually quite healthy about that. And it's part of our individualistic age that we think if we do fall out with someone, that's between us. But actually it affects the whole church, Paul saying. So what does he, how does he alleviate that perhaps to our minds slightly cruel naming and shaming of these particular women? What else does he say in those verses? Does he? What, can you read that, Sue?
Is he minded?
Ah, yeah, no, it's not different. Who's my true part? Yes, Sisygus. Yeah. Okay. There are various theories about that, and Sue's right. It may be the bearer of the letter. It may be that the word for companion, yoke, fellow, whatever, is actually a proper name. There is no evidence for that at all. We don't know anyone else with that name. I mean, it may be like, no, it's like calling someone Spiller, because we have no records of anyone ever being called that. Spiller. Although, actually, I'll tell Paul and Jenny, because they're both nowadays, you can do anything, can't you? But so, one view is that kind of you know who you are, and there may have been a kind of secret little PS or something. So he's named and shamed the women, but who it is that he has particularly given the task of working for Reconciliation, he, I think, deliberately doesn't tell us and doesn't tell them, which is interesting. What else does he say about them? Okay, so he bigs them up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And something else. Yeah, absolutely. It's very easy, or it is for me, I don't know whether you find this as well. If someone in the church does something really horrible, it's very easy to say, oh, well, they're not, this because they're not real Christians. You know, when you hear of, like, child abuse cases or that kind of thing, you think, well, they can't possibly be a real Christian because they wouldn't do anything like that, you know. And Paul is at great pains to say they are Christians, and I know they're Christians because in the past they've been really at the front line of the gospel and the mission of the church. So it's a real, he hits them, but then he bigs them up and he puts something, we don't know what, in place to try and bring about this reconciliation. Because there's a lot at stake. They're fighting under the tortoise shell, and you can't do that. Yeah?
Okay.
So I think there's some interesting insights there into when things in church do go wrong. You know, and he doesn't pull any punches in dealing with it, but he does put those other correctives in as well. Okay, let's come back to the inward focus. And I do think the key word there in verse 5 is all. Let your gentleness be evident to all. And very often in the New Testament and in the letters, you get right behaviour as an evangelistic strategy. So, for example, I can't remember offhand now where it is, but there's a passage about women not wearing makeup or earrings or that kind of stuff, you know. And to our minds, that's kind of very bleh. But actually, when you look into it, it's an evangelistic strategy, because those kind of women were the sort of women who were prized in that society, rightly or wrongly. That's how it was. And if the church gets known for having a bunch of women who are not like that, that's a negative thing evangelistically. Cool, I don't want to join that lot. Look at their women, they all wear earrings, for goodness sake, you know. And there's quite a few passages like that where he says, you know, behave rightly because of what the world will think of you. And I think there's something there about wanting to be winsome as a congregation, so that you can win some. See what I did there? When I was at school, we used to have a little saying, no grizzlers in our gang. And anyone who started being a bit miserable like that, they would be treated with that. No grizzlers in our gang. And I think that's quite a good motto for church, actually. Because we've got to look good in the eyes of the world. There's ways of looking good, obviously, and other ways of not. But there is something about coming over as happy and gentle, which is the particular thing there. It's quite hard not to like people who are gentle. Okay, third attack, verses 6-7. Do not be anxious about anything. Who has ever laid awake at night worrying about stuff? Why do we do that? Why do we do it? And it's the most silly things usually, isn't it? And there's a really brilliant song by my hero is Graham Kendrick. Sorry, I'm so old, but he's just the best. But he talks about, I can't remember the actual words now, but nights when sleep has fled away or something like that.
Yeah.
Nights of doubt. And it's a universal human experience. And if we think we've got stuff to worry about, give a thought for Paul, you know. Now, it's worth saying here that Paul is not talking about the kind of anxiety that is a symptom of mental health issues. I think that's a different thing. Whether they had that in those days, I don't know. We do seem to be inventing lots and lots more illnesses as the human race continues. But so I don't think he's talking about that. But what's his answer to the kind of anxiety that we... And how does that happen? How does the peace of God... Yeah, it comes to us through prayer and petition. So who has laid awake at night worrying about stuff and prayed about it? Yeah? But has anyone ever laid awake at night worrying about it and prayed about it and then carried on worrying? Oh, yes.
It's so easily done, isn't it?
So what's Paul he's saying very clearly here, don't be anxious about anything, but in every situation by prayer. Why is that not always the solution that he seems to promise? Okay, it's not just prayer. What sort of prayer is he recommending for anxiety? Thanksgiving. There's another. I'm fascinated to know what that sounds like in Norwegian. Okay. So there's something about calling on God. Anyone else got anything there to help us? It's getting a
picture,
kind of vision of God that's it does put yeah, there's the thankfulness bit, but there's another bit as well alongside that I'm interested in. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
I've got prayer and petition with thanksgiving present your requests to God. And I think that is about two ways of praying, which we're not always good at in the middle of the night. Praying specifically and praying thankfully. Presenting your request to God. And I think sometimes God is sitting up there listening to our prayers and we're going, oh God, you know, everything's so terrible and I'm in a mess and I'm... And God's sitting there saying, so what do you want me to do? Oh, well, you know, life's terrible and I'm so worried about this. Okay, what would you like me to do? Well, it's just a big... Do you know what I mean? You ever been in that kind of a scenario? And I think that Paul's encouraging them there to be specific in their prayers, to tell God exactly what they need. And part of anxiety, of course, is that we don't know what we need. It's just a mess. It's just a you know, kind of panic thing. And I think Paul's saying, okay, slow down. Tell God what it is you want him to do and thank him. And that will get rid of that anxiety. Do you remember we talked last time? About whether you can command someone to rejoice or not. Remember that? And we said, if the facts are there, then you can rejoice. Yeah, it's not just, oh, cheer yourself up. It's cheer yourself up because. And I think that exactly the same thing works here with that anxiety. Going back to the end of verse 5, the Lord is near, so don't be anxious about anything. I wonder whether that verse division isn't quite in the right place. Let your gentleness be evident to all. new verse. The Lord is near, so don't be anxious about anything. Get back in touch with those facts. You know? Mm. Remind yourself, particularly in this this Advent time, we know the end of the story. We've been told how this is going to pan out. And yes, there'll be some roller coaster moments along the way. But hey, so give thanks to God for that. Tell him exactly what it is that you want him to do for you now. Okay, makes sense. Mm. I think that's probably what he's saying there. And then the last one, what I've called pollution, and what others of you have said, staying focused on good things and so on. It's said that you are what you eat, but also I think you are what you think to some degree. What you feed your mind on. Mm-hmm. I might have told you before the story about the Native American Christian who was a fairly young Christian, and he was talking to his pastor and he said, "How are you doing, you know, in your new faith?" And he said, "Well, it's a real struggle." And he said, "It's like I've got a big black dog on one side of me and a big white dog on the other side of me. And the black one's trying to, kind of get at me all the time. And the white one's fighting the black one and so on." And the pastor said, "And which one wins?" And he said, "The one I feed the most." And there's something, I'm sorry about the implied racism in that story, but that's how it was told in the time when we were less sensitive. But, you know, that kind of thing, what we feed becomes stronger, and what we starve becomes weaker. And he lists all these things that need feeding and that our minds need feeding on. And you could do a whole study on each of those words, because they're all quite powerful and potent words with a lot behind them. Whatever is noble, I mean, that's a brilliant word, isn't it? There's so much to it. Whatever's right, knowing, pardon me, right from wrong. Whatever's pure, lovely, admirable, excellent, praiseworthy. Feed your minds on those kind of things. And then finally, this motif which we saw before. Whatever you've learnt or received or heard from me or seen in me, just do that. You'd be a right incredible thing from a church leader. But as we said a couple of weeks ago, Paul's not ashamed to say that. His life is exemplary. And if they're going to follow him, they're going to be fine. And then the God of peace will be with you. Okay, any other points that come out of that for people? This is our friend Sonia, and that's Chris obviously, but that's our friend Sonia, and she absolutely embodies that verse. She is the most content person. Even when I poured salad cream over her new settee, her carpet and her ceiling in our first
staff meeting.
We were on staff of that church, and we had lunch and it was a bottle of salad cream. And what do you do when you get a bottle of salad cream? You give it a good shake like that. Well, she should have put the lid on, that's all I can say. And there's this arc of salad cream went all around. But no, she just is the. And I can remember I was preaching. I had to preach on this verse, And if you were to ask me what I find the most difficult verse in the whole of the Bible, I would tell you this verse. And I can remember ringing her up and saying, Sonia, what's the secret of your success? Why are you the most content person? And of course she didn't know, she just was, she